From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, FSN's correspondent is on the Iraq front line, where Kurdish fighters are positioned just a kilometre from advancing Islamic militants.
There's a tree line and a line of houses in the distance, which is where the Peshmerga say ISIS militants currently are. This is a very well fortified front line.
Also today, terror alert in Uganda after the US embassy warns of an imminent attack on an international airport. And we hear from the grandson of famed oceanographer Jacques Cousteau as he breaks an underwater record.
Magic, or the luxury of saturation diving, of living on the final frontier, which is our oceans, is that it gives us the luxury of time. And that's something that's very, very rare.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. New security procedures have been implemented at airports in Britain after the US government said it's worried about threats to aviation security. Travellers to the US are being warned by the British authorities to have their battery-powered devices available for separate inspection before boarding non-stop flights to America. Security expert Tim Williams says the US government is worried that ISIS militants operating in Iraq and Syria might turn to terrorism in a bid to demonstrate their growing influence.
ISIS split from Al-Qaeda in January, and there is a concern that as it tries to announce its presence on the world stage, that it might seek to target the West.
Meanwhile, in Uganda, the US embassy warned of a plan to conduct a terrorist operation at Entebbe Airport near Kampala. FSN's Isabel Nakiria reports from our bureau there on the reaction of the Ugandan authorities.
Military and anti-terror police are patrolling the center of Kampala after the publication of the terror threat. The country's civil aviation authority says security has been beefed up at Entebbe International Airport, but says travelers should not expect any delays. Ugandans have been subjected to searches on the streets of Kampala today.
US intelligence officials are debating whether Iraqi insurgents are preparing a major assault on the capital, Baghdad. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Daniel Wrenches reports.
One US intelligence official speaking to Reuters says there's evidence that the Iraqi insurgent group ISIS is preparing forces to attack Baghdad, utilizing the chaos caused by coordinated suicide attacks. Iraqi officials say there are multiple sleeper cells preparing for the advance. But here in Washington, some analysts doubt the logic of a large-scale assault on the capital, which they believe would overextend the Sunni extremist forces.
Israel is sending military reinforcements to the Gaza Strip as tensions mount following the murders of four teenagers. The funeral of 17-year-old Mohammed Abu Qader was delayed, so a post-mortem examination could be conducted. Pressure is mounting on the British government to launch an independent inquiry into allegations that a paedophile ring was operating in the British Parliament in the 1970s and 80s. The opposition Labour Party is now calling on Prime Minister David Cameron to authorise the inquiry after a retired government minister said he doesn't know what happened to a dossier from the 1980s detailing the ring's activities. Lord Paddy Ashdown, the former leader of Britain's Liberal Democrats, says it's too early to launch a government probe.
The police are now inquiring into this, and I think you need to leave it to them. If you have a further inquiry at this stage, I think you're simply getting their way. I'm not saying that once they have done their inquiry and reached their conclusions, there may not be a case for this, but there isn't one now.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose above the 17,000-point benchmark following the publication of strong monthly job figures in the US. The Labour Department data showed 288,000 jobs were created last month. From FSN's business desk in New York, Nick Harper reports.
Wall Street was very happy with the jobs figures. The Dow, S&P and Nasdaq all up at the opening bell. In particular, the Dow Jones rose above the 17,000-point mark for the first time in its history. It comes after the news that the US economy added 288,000 jobs in June and unemployment fell to 6.1%, its lowest level since September 2008. The Dow, S&P and Nasdaq have all hit record closes this week, and with Wall Street closed on Friday for Independence Day, this could be a strong close to the trading week.
Russia has vetoed the filming of the popular online television drama House of Cards inside the UN Security Council chamber. It's understood that producers approached the UN about filming for an upcoming series, but Russia blocked it. From FSN's Moscow bureau, Natalie Powell reports.
According to reports, Russia's reason for blocking filming access was so the chamber could be kept free at all times in case it was needed for emergency talks at short notice. Filming of the popular US drama, which stars Kevin Spacey, at the UN Security Council chamber had allegedly been recommended by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's office. Foreign Policy magazine cites it was thought the out-of-hours filming would raise public awareness about the UN. It's also thought that China had been concerned about the filming, but would have granted access following script approval. It's understood that House of Cards episodes may still be filmed in other sections of the UN's headquarters.
You can find us online at featurestory.com and on Twitter at featurestory. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The leader of Iraq's Kurdish region has called for a referendum on independence, in a move that comes as a blow to White House efforts to unite the country's politicians against advancing jihadist fighters.
The United States continues to support an Iraq that is democratic, pluralistic, and unified, and we're going to continue to urge all parties in Iraq to continue working together toward that objective.
Over 700 U.S. troops have been deployed to the country in what's been called an advisory capacity. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel today said the top priority for the U.S. in Iraq is securing the American embassy and protecting U.S. citizens.
We're helping provide our diplomats time and space to work with Sunni, Kurd, Shia political leaders as they attempt to form a new, inclusive national unity government.
FSN's Ollie Barrett is on special assignment in Iraq and today travelled to the northern city of Kirkuk to the Kurdish front line, just 1 kilometre from ISIS militants.
These are the Peshmerga front lines on the outskirts of the city of Kirkuk. We are approximately a kilometre away from ISIS militants. There's a tree line and a line of houses in the distance, which is where the Peshmerga say ISIS militants currently are. This is a very well fortified front line. The Peshmerga forces here are very strong, very well trained and very well resourced. Nonetheless, there is, of course, an air of tension. Here, we've been shown earlier places where mortar strikes from militants have taken place in this area. And so Peshmerga forces on alert, but they say this is one of many areas, most areas around the city of Kirkuk now that they control.
Ollie, can you tell us a bit more about Kirkuk and where you are now and how that city is implicated in this current rebel insurgency?
Yes, Kirkuk, an incredibly important city to the Kurds. It is oil-rich, but it's also important spiritually, really, to the Kurdistan region. It's often described as Kurdistan's Jerusalem. Peshmerga forces now control most of it, which has long been an ambition of the Kurds, although the Kurds insist they only moved in here because Iraqi forces fled this area as soon as ISIS militants attacked. Nonetheless, the Kurds will not be wanting to give Kirkuk over to anyone else's control. Now, they consider it a Kurdish city, and the fact that it is oil-rich is, of course, part of the equation too.
And what's the situation like so close to the front line? And just how is this ISIS offensive affecting that key area?
Yes, I mean, slightly further back from the front lines, this is a pretty calm, safe city now. The Kurds have it well secured, but still, of course, that air of uneasy calm. There's also the irony here of this being an oil-rich city, but a city in which people are queuing for hour after hour after hour to get petrol because of the problems at refineries across Iraq, with many of them having been attacked by militants. So in this oil-rich city, we've been driving past queues over a mile long of people waiting to get petrol. There have been a couple of suicide attacks here in the last week or so, but this, compared to some other Iraqi cities at the moment, is a reasonably safe place. The Kurdish Peshmerga forces have secured it, and we have a referendum looming in the coming months, and Kurdistan wants Kirkuk to vote in that referendum, and of course hopes that it will vote in that referendum to stay a part of an independent Kurdistan.
FSN's Ollie Barrett in the northern Iraq city of Kirkuk. This is FSN Reports. The US is warning Americans in Uganda about what it calls a specific threat of an attack on Entebbe International Airport. The US embassy announced that Ugandan police believe the attack near the capital city of Kampala would happen between 9 and 11 p.m. local time. Authorities have not yet linked any militant group with the threat. Leon Senyange is in Kampala.
Well, Kevin, I should tell you that suddenly there's been a lot of security building up in at the international airport because of the terror threat that came through. This was an announcement made by police. I think suddenly it was done yesterday. And the Civil Aviation Authority has taken on the responsibilities of security just as well as the police. And there's been deployment of the police and anti-terror squad at the airport. Of course, travel has been interrupted. Several delays for those coming in and those intending to travel through Entebbe International Airport. Lots of checks going on at the airport. And even out of the airport, the capital itself, Kampala, there's been a couple of police searches around, several checks at different points, and a lot of patrolling by the anti-terror squad in Kampala. Definitely, the alert is quite high, and we expect that this will go on for the next 2 days.
And that same alert was issued by the U.S. Embassy there in Kampala. What have they been advising U.S. citizens in Kampala?
Well, of course, they're telling them to be careful with their travels, but there's... I should say that we've spoken to the Civil Aviation Authority, and the same thing is going on as normal, despite the vigorous checks by the terror squad and the local police. But just as much, citizens, regardless of whether they're U.S. citizens or not, have been told to be aware of any eventuality that could come through today.
And Leon, what security measures have Ugandan authorities been taking in response to this warning?
Well, certainly, there's been very, very strong measures that have been taken on. And Entebbe International Airport, there's been a deployment of anti-terror squad. And all the way on the highway from the airport way to the capital itself. And within the capital also, there's been deployment of both police and anti-terror squad. And they've been patrolling the streets all day, and they'll continue to do that tonight and just as much for the next few days.
And have Ugandan authorities linked this threat to any particular group?
Well, no particular group has been affected in this particular threat. However, the Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group, certainly comes top on the list for the local police. They're currently in a crisis, in a meeting over the discussion of the terror alert. They, however, point their fingers at the Al-Shabaab because the Al-Shabaab have hit Uganda before, 4 years ago, during the World Cup match. There was an attack at the rugby ground. Suddenly, that is the only group they'll be pointing their fingers to.
Leon Senyange in Kampala. The Ugandan terror threat came as extra security measures were being rolled out at European airports with direct flights to America after warnings from the US of a credible threat. The increased security follows fresh intelligence from US agencies and reports that Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria and Yemen are developing bombs that can be smuggled onto planes that are not picked up by metal detectors. The UK Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg has been telling Britain's LBC Radio these measures are not a blip, but will be around for some time.
I think the first thing is that this government, any government around the world, our first duty is to keep people safe. And what you've got to remember is that there are individuals and groups, terrorist groups, violent extremist groups around the world who want to do us harm. They are constantly thinking, how can we do damage? How can we inflict violence? How can we maim and kill people in the United States, the United Kingdom and elsewhere? We know that. The thing is, they're constantly trying to think of new ways to do that. So we need to constantly think of new ways to keep ourselves safe. And that, in a nutshell, is what this is about, is that, you know, a decision has been arrived at that we need to adjust, tighten up the checks at airports. This involves a whole range of different countries in order to make sure that our defences keep up, if you like, with the changing methods that these groups are exploring.
And in practical terms, what does it mean for passengers, people arriving at airports later today or through the week?
Well, I don't think I should start...
Presumably longer time, well, more checks.
We don't think the majority of travellers going on holiday, going elsewhere for business, are going to be unduly disrupted.
So it's just US we're looking at.
It's certainly a lot of the original announcements, as you know, came from the US, and this involves a whole range of countries. So we're not just alone in this, and it will involve extra checks of various descriptions. The checks that we have in terms of passengers who go on aeroplanes, how they're scrutinised, how they're checked, is, you know, in the jargon, it's sort of multi-layered. And so there's going to be another layer for some travellers on some flights. That, you know, that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. I don't think people should be unduly panicked or concerned, but this is the world we now live in. This won't be the last time that there are further adjustments made, because we're having to constantly evolve our own defences in view of the evolving way in which people want to attack us.
And lastly, this is in place for days, weeks, months, forever. How long?
Oh, I think I don't think we should expect this to be just a sort of one-off temporary thing. We have to make sure that the checks are there to meet the nature of the new kinds of threats.
So forever.
Well, whether it's forever, I can't make any predictions forever. But I don't want people to think that this is just a sort of, you know, blip for a week. This is part of an evolving and constant review about whether the checks we have in our airports, and indeed in other places of entry and exit from countries, keeps up with the kind of what we know from intelligence and all other sources, what we know about the nature of the threats that we face.
UK Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg on Britain's LBC Radio. Now, the grandson of legendary French oceanographer Jacques Cousteau spent his first day back on dry land today after spending a record 31 days at an underwater laboratory. Fabien Cousteau and a team of aquanauts from two US universities spent the last month on board the Aquarius Lab, 63 feet below the surface of the ocean off the Florida Keys. Our US correspondent Steve Mort reports.
Back on the surface after a month living underwater, Fabien Cousteau says he's already missing life beneath the waves.
Hey, Doc.
Welcome back.
I wish I could say I was happy to be here.
Arriving back on dry land, Cousteau and his team of scientists have been gathering data on a nearby coral reef. Cousteau says the information they've collected on marine life and ocean pollution, including contamination left over from the BP oil spill, is enough to fill 10 scientific papers.
The magic or the luxury of saturation diving, of living on the final frontier, which is our oceans, is that it gives us the luxury of time. And that's something that's very, very rare. It's an invaluable tool to do science for lengthy periods of time.
The scientists on board the Aquarius Lab during the 31-day mission claim they've gathered the equivalent of 2 years of data in just 1 month. Mark Patterson is a professor at Northeastern University.
So we've got a really good look at what a day in the life of a sponge is like. And since all the water in a coral reef is estimated to go through the body of a sponge every 24 to 48 hours, that's a really important data set.
By spending 31 days underwater, Fabien Cousteau beats his grandfather Jacques Cousteau's record of 30 days beneath the Red Sea in the 1960s on the underwater colony Conshelf 2.
Mission 31 is really based on Conshelf 2 as a symbolic platform for many reasons, for inspiration of the general public, for the fact that habitats are few and far between. As a matter of fact, this is the only undersea marine laboratory left in the world, and as such, we need to bring attention to it and leverage that attention to spawn off new habitats in different parts of the world, because as a final frontier, This is one of those places that gives us a frontline view of what's going on in the ocean when we're not around.
Fabien Cousteau and his team are now being monitored by doctors after their time living under pressure without sunlight, but such checks are unlikely to keep this explorer away from his family business for long. Steve Mort in the Florida Keys.
A San Francisco-based artist has brought a collaborative arts project to one of the city's poorest neighbourhoods, aiming to provoke an international discussion about what Nelson Mandela means to young people. Art teacher William Rhodes found that following Mandela's passing, many of his pupils wanted to know more about the legendary anti-apartheid icon. That led to an idea of making a quilt, following the example of plantation-era works, incorporating pictures, collage and paintings. Later, the children's individual patches of quilt will be taken to South Africa. Rebecca Bowring reports.
At one time, South Africa was a place where not everyone was treated fairly.
Artist William Rhodes is opening the minds of 7- and 8-year-olds to the story of Nelson Mandela.
Mr. Mandela went to jail for many years trying to fight to change some of these injustices.
And encouraging them to connect with Madiba's values of peace, love and forgiveness through art.
We're going to start to work on fabric.
Rhodes has a vision, a Nelson Mandela International quilt composed of squares designed by schoolchildren in the US and South Africa. He's brought the project to a summer school in the marginalized San Francisco neighborhood of Bayview Hunters Point.
Some have never left their neighborhoods or their community, and to actually do a project with kids in South Africa is revolutionary in many ways. You know, it gives them the opportunity to kind of expand their horizons.
Having seen what their peers in South Africa are working on, these third grade students start their contribution, painting symbols and words associated with Madiba. They're inspired by pictures of world peacemakers and their own friends and families. Supervising teacher Brenda Dupre says discussing influential people of color has been central to her curriculum.
Our school is 99.8% African American. And because as I teach the children, when you know who you are and where you come from, then you have a better vision of knowing where you're going in life.
That can be tough in this community. Once a thriving industrial area, Bayview Hunters Point now has San Francisco's highest unemployment rate. The neighborhood accounts for 5% of the city's population and around 30% of its homicides. Dupre hopes pupils like Damarian Brian Miller and Lamaya Stern will be inspired to dream big dreams because of Mandela's example.
He went to jail for many years, and then he got out, and then he became the president.
He cared for everybody, and he didn't want anybody to get hurt.
The patches from this school will be symbolically sewn together with those made by children in South Africa. The finished Mandela quilts will go on tour and then be donated to the Lalela Project, an NGO which, through art, offers better opportunities to South African youth living in poverty. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, French police have made a fresh attempt to clear a makeshift refugee camp in the northern port of Calais. More than 300 people were detained, and there are reports that tear gas was used to stop some of the migrants from fleeing. It's not the first time the police have moved in to clear land that lies close to the main ferry port in Calais and the Channel Tunnel that leads all the way to London, the migrants' ultimate favoured destination. The Financial Times Paris correspondent Hugh Carnegie recently visited Calais and filed this report.
Every day in the French port of Calais, thousands of travellers pass through by ferry and train on their way to and from the United Kingdom, 20 miles away across the English Channel. But for hundreds of migrants from Africa, the Middle East and beyond, Calais is a miserable dead end.
For years, the French authorities have struggled to cope with a steady stream of people trying to reach England. But an increasingly tough immigration policy by the UK and growing conflicts in Africa and the Middle East have made the situation more difficult. The result is a growing backlog of migrants scratching out an existence in Calais as they desperately try to smuggle a ride across the Channel.
Ali from Afghanistan is one of 30 migrants who have recently been on hunger strike in protest at the conditions they are forced to live in while they try to reach the UK.
Now I don't have the life.
Why am I going to England? Because I don't have work. I don't have a life. What is really important for us is school and a house and documents. I don't need only this, staying here in Calais.
In May, the French authorities used bulldozers to dismantle three makeshift camps around the town. They said there had been an outbreak of scabies in the camps that threatened public health. There has been no permanent camp with proper facilities for the migrants since Britain won agreement from Paris 12 years ago to close down a Red Cross centre at Sangatte outside Calais. But the migrants keep coming, from Sudan, from Syria, from Ethiopia, with some 800 now said to be in the Calais area. Many have been squatting at a food distribution point near the ferry port. As Thomas from Eritrea complains, the conditions are squalid, with just one water point and three toilets.
When I entered this place, you see this area, everyone has problems. There's no food, no toilet. If you go, chances are the police will beat you and arrest you. That's a problem. It's difficult. Last time the police beat me, and I'm sick of this now.
The migrants make daily attempts to get to England by smuggling themselves onto trains travelling down the Channel Tunnel or onto trucks taking the ferry to Dover. With Britain refusing to accept them, the French authorities use special sensors that can detect human breathing and heartbeats, sniffer dogs and surveillance cameras to try to intercept them. It's a dangerous game. Aid workers say 8 migrants have been killed this year trying to make the crossing. Alain Gérard, head of the Calais sous-préfecture, says the police make up to 1,400 interceptions a month.
There are attempts every night, and every night and every day we detect migrants in the lorries. What I can tell you is that the number of detections we've made has risen considerably.
The vast majority of migrants refuse to stay in France. They say they want to go to Britain because they believe they will find it easier to find work and to study there. It is a hope fueled by the people smugglers, who charge the migrants large sums for the promise of a passage to England. Riyad from Darfur paid $1,000 to get to Calais via Libya and a boat across the Mediterranean.
We love England, you know? Why? We want to speak English. We want to study there. Me, it's also me. I'm never studying in my country. I live in I'm leaving the study about the schools in 2006. I'm never studying.
The dream of a better life in Britain is too often an illusion, says Christian Salomé, who works with a French charity assisting the migrants.
As far as we are concerned, we don't see the solution because these people think that the life is better somewhere else. It's false, but they must go to the end of their dream to see that it is false.
The origins of the misery in Calais lie thousands of miles away in countries suffering from government oppression, civil wars, and deep-seated poverty. The migrants here just want a chance to carve out a new life in the peaceful and prosperous West. But as long as the UK and other European governments remain determined to restrict immigration, the plight of the people here in Calais looks certain to continue. Hugh Carnegie, The Financial Times, Calais.
And you can see the images to go with that report on the Financial Times website. They are stunning. Just go to video.ft.com. That's video.ft.com. And you can read Hugh Carnegie's reporting from France daily in the newspaper and on its website, ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. Coming up on Friday, in this special edition of the programme, one of the first female television war correspondents talks about her new book on the legacy of women in World War One. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.